History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions, and then, just as importantly, to invest enough time to patiently listen as memories which may have been buried for decades start to emerge from the shadows again. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom, and in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we really do end up inspired by these stories. Stories from our greatest generation. 77 years ago this weekend, the world was forever changed. A B-29 superfortress dubbed Enola Gay took off from the tiny island of Tinian and deployed a bomb called Little Boy over Hiroshima, Japan. It was a shocking day. It was a tragic day. It was a pivotal day. But 77 years later, very few people who played a role in that development are still here to talk about it. One of them is Norris Jernigan, who was a young intelligence clerk with the 393rd Bomb Squadron, part of the 509th Composite Group. You've heard Norris's story on Hometown Heroes before, and maybe you've even seen the photo of his baby face sticking out of the cockpit window of Enola Gay, just like the famous shot of that B-29's pilot, Paul Tibbetts. But we have not heard about his most recent experience with a B-29. Because it happened not too long ago in a remote corner of the map where a prelude to that chapter of history occurred, a place called Wendover, Utah.
Yeah, the end of the world. Stuck out there on the edge of the Salt Flats, right on the Nevada-Utah border. And that was the base that we trained in before we went overseas. It's a deactivated base now, but they're trying to restore it somewhat, and it's called the Historic Wendover Airfield now because of the history of the trained groups that came through there and went out overseas. So many of them, B-17 groups, went to Europe. There was a fighter group that trained there. And of course, our group was a B-29 group. We were the last group to train there. We left there in the spring of 1945 to go to the island of Tinian.
So what happened when you went there this time? What made this so special?
Well, this time, the director of the Restoration Committee of Wendover, Utah, called me and said that the B-29 dock was going to be landing there, be there for a couple of days in early May, and invited me to come. And I gave it some thought, and I thought, well, you know, I love to go back to the old base. It brings back a lot of memories and the friends that I had there when we trained together. So I said, yeah, I'll go. So I flew into Salt Lake City, and he picked me up and drove me out to Wendover. Right soon after I arrived out there, the B-29 dock came in for a landing. They were there to take passengers up, and they charge for it, but they had a seat reserved for me at no charge to take a flight on the B-29. So anyhow, when I crawled up in the fuselage, I was given the seat right up in the front. Would have been the bombardier's seat right up in the nose of the airplane. So I was surrounded by the nose cone, which is plexiglass. And what a view, and what a thrill, too.
I'm guessing you had never sat in that position in a B-29 in flight before, right?
That's correct. Oh, no, I never qualified for that. No.
What did that feel like?
Well, it was wonderful just being in the B-29 again. I was not flight crew, but I was part of the group that was a B-29 group, and knew all the guys that were in the flight crew status. And a lot of friends, but they're all gone now. So anyhow, I sat in the seat that is a very integral part of the flight. The bombardier is the man that finds the target, uses his bomb sight, and when he's got it in his target, he lets the bomb go. So it was an honor just to be in that position because I'd never flown in that position before.
Any other memorable experience while you were there? I'm sure a lot of people wanted to meet you, get your autograph, take pictures with you. What was that like?
I did, and KSL, the NBC news people in Salt Lake City came down in a helicopter to cover the event of the airplane being there and interviewed me. And they put together a special that they aired on Memorial Day, and was really ironic. My niece's in-laws were traveling in Utah at that time, and they were watching the KSL news in the evening, and I suddenly said, there's Norris. So they included my interview on the news release. So it was quite an honor.
If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, I have a link to that KSL television report by Andrew Adams that chronicles Norris Jernigan's return to Wendover. You can see him in the nose of that B-29 dock. That represents the most recent chapter in Jernigan's story, but the path there began when he left high school after his junior year to join the Army Air Corps.
Well, went into active duty and was sent to Shepherd Field, Texas for the Army basic training, because back then the Air Force was part of the Army. It was right. A division of the Army. Took my basic training there and then went on to the next step of the cadet program. Was sent to Denver and enrolled in Denver University for a semester. And that's where we had our first flying lessons. It was some small private field near Denver. I think his name was Hayden Field, but I'm not really positive about that anymore. But had my 10 hours of flight instruction there. Then after the semester was ended, came time for our school squadron to be sent to a classification center to decide whether we qualified for further pilot training or whether we would go to navigator school or bombardier school or somewhere else. Well, when we got to, it was in Santa Ana, California. When we got there, we checked daily to see what the list looked like, where we would go. The pilot list, the bombardier list, and the navigator list wasn't growing very fast, but the somewhere else list was. One day there was my name on the somewhere else, and so that was the end of my cadet training. We wondered why, because about two-thirds of my school squadron was eliminated.
Wow.
The reason they gave us was that they were gaining a surplus of aviation students to go on to the next step. So, you know, in the military, you just can't have people sitting around doing nothing. So we were eliminated from the program to free up the backlog of people waiting for further training. They decided to send me to Amarillo, Texas, to go to airplane mechanic school. There again, the wisdom of the military decided... I was mechanically inclined, and about as mechanically inclined as a black cat, I guess you'd say. Anyhow, went down there, and we laid around there waiting for the next class to start up. And after about 4 or 5 weeks, they called us together and said that they had decided to close that school, and we would be sent to a redistribution center, which was in Salt Lake City. Set up there, and... was there about 2 weeks, I guess, while they were trying to decide where to send everybody. They were just funneling them through there and sending them out. And finally, they said, well, they're closing so many of the schools now. We're going to be sending you out to tactical groups that are training for overseas duty, and you'll be going out of here as an on-the-job trainee. So they sent me to Fairmont, Nebraska to become part of a B-29 group. Well, I'd never heard of a B-29, but... anyhow, we went to Fairmont, Nebraska, worked in the motor pool for a little while because they sent me out as a truck driver. There again, the wisdom of the Army.
They keep checking boxes you weren't willing to check for yourself, huh?
Yeah, but, you know, you have decisions made for you, which I wasn't used to. And anyhow, I was there just about a month, maybe. And as the number of people grew, they finally broke us into three different squadrons. And there was the 393rd Bomb Squadron, the 398th Bomb Squadron, and the 421st Bomb Squadron. I wound up in the 393rd Bomb Squadron. And one day, one of the guys that was in the administrative office, which we referred to as the orderly room, was going through the personnel records and noticed that I had been with the cadet program and I just had completed a semester at Denver University. Called me in and said, I see you were in the cadet program. What are you doing driving a truck? And I said, well, you don't argue. You do and go where you're told and you do what you're told to do. We had three answers, yes, sir, no excuse, sir. Anyhow, he said, well, I'll tell you, there's an opening in the intelligence office here in the squadron if you're interested. It requires some typing. And I said, well, that's no problem. I took a semester of high school typing. So he said, well, if you're interested, go over and talk to him. So I did. I went over to the intelligence office, and they decided to give me a try. So I worked went into the intelligence office as an on-the-job trainee. And I was with the 393rd Bomb Squadron Intelligence Office for the rest of the time I was in the service.
And that would really change your life.
Yes.
I'm curious, the time when you were in the cadet program, when you actually got to fly, what was that like for you and what were you flying?
Piper Cubs.
Uh-huh.
Yes. I had never been up in an airplane before. That first takeoff, it was just so exciting, you know. About the second or third lesson, they switch around their instructors. I had a woman pilot instructor. And in the old Piper Cub, they had what they called the Gosport. It was the communications, the intercom system, mm-hmm. which was really almost like the old can with a string to the other can. You know? It was a tube connected to just like funnels that you would talk into. And started down the runway, and she said, get on that right rudder, get on that right rudder, get on that right rudder. She got to the high-pitched pitch, and I got so confused, I hit the left rudder. We went out across the field. I thought, oh, boy, I'm washed out of this, too, now. Anyhow, we circled around, got on the runway again, and made a perfect takeoff. So I redeemed myself, but I don't know why. I got so confused that I would go, I knew right from left, but that high-pitched screaming, get on that right rudder, get on that right rudder. Because you had to ride the right rudder because of the torque. You'd uh-huh. drift to the left. To stay on the runway, you had to stay on that rudder. That was exciting. And then when it came to the what they call the five-hour check after you've had 5 hours of instruction, then you had somebody come in that you didn't even know that was checked you out and made a perfect takeoff. Went out to the practice area where I always practiced. Went through all the routine of the stalls and everything else that I was supposed to do. And he said, okay, now take us back to the airport. Where's the airport? Always before, the instructor flew it out there to the practice area and then flew it back to the airport and then turned it over to the student to land the plane. I remembered a railroad track that we kept almost following, and so I thought, well, where's a railroad track? And I spotted it, and so I just wheeled around and followed that thing, and sure enough, it took us back to the airport. Redeemed myself again. But I was, you know, I was crushed when I got washed out of the program because, you know, you make such a big thing back home about you're going to become a pilot. I was going to fly a B-17, the biggest airplane they had at that time. And now tell them, well, I'm a airplane mechanic or I'm a truck driver. But, you know, ego enters into it, I guess. But anyhow, it was tough being washed out of the program.
And little did you know that you would end up with a lifelong connection to an even bigger plane, a B-29,
yes.
Probably the most famous B-29 of all time.
Absolutely. And when we first were cut off into squadrons, we became the squadrons for the 504th Bomb Group. And they were training for overseas duty, and they call them a tactical unit, which means they're actually seriously training for overseas duty. We, at first, didn't have any B-29s. They were using B-17s to begin their training. And then when the first B-29 showed up, I just couldn't believe what a huge aircraft that was. Of course, now it's very small compared to what's in the air now. But then the B-29 started arriving, and so they transitioned into the B-29, and the 393rd Bomb Squadron was really making great headway in their training. We started our training in the spring of 1944, and by the end of August, all of the squadrons, especially the 393rd, was complete with their training. They were ready to go overseas. All of a sudden, orders came through transferring the 393rd Bomb Squadron away from the 504th and sending us to Wendover Field, Utah. Well, never heard of Wendover Field because I'd never been there before, but anyhow, we got to Wendover, and what a cultural shock that was. Out there on the salt flats, away from everything, 120 miles west of Salt Lake City, the little town of Wendover was nothing. It was just a small casino and then a small state line hotel was all that was there, really, and a few citizens.
And there was a reason they wanted you all in the middle of nowhere.
Exactly, and we found that out later. Well, about the second day we were there, the enlisted men, I understand the officers were pulled into the one of the theaters and briefed, and the enlisted men in our squadron, we were told to assemble out in front of the orderly room, this lieutenant colonel hopped up on the back of a truck so he could see everybody and said, "All right, men, gather around. I want to talk to you." So he said, introduced himself. He says, "I'm Lieutenant Colonel Paul Tibbetts, and I want you to know that you've been brought here for a purpose. You're going to become part of an organization that's going to be handling a new secret weapon that, if successful, should shorten the war by at least 2 years. Now, it's top secret, high security. You're not to talk to anybody. You're not to tell anybody where you're stationed. You're not to talk to anybody about what you're doing. You're not supposed to talk to each other. So I want you now to all go on a two-week furlough. Go home, get rested up, come back, because we're going to go into an intense training program and get ready to go overseas." Well, of course, we were so excited to find out we were going to be something special. But he stressed again, remember, top secret, security is high, so don't tell anybody anything. So we left to go on a two-week leave, but what we didn't know, he wasn't concerned about us getting rested up. It was a test to see if anybody could keep their mouth shut. Some of the guys, when they got home, had telegrams waiting for them to report back to the base immediately. And they found out when they got back to the base, they had just casually mentioned something to somebody about where they were stationed or going to be involved in something special or whatever, whatever they talked about. There was one story that was circulated, and we never could find out whether it was true or not, but it certainly made an impression on us that they really meant business about this security. It seems that one of the guys that was going on leave, while he was waiting to get his bus, train, or airplane, wherever it was, decided to go in the bar and have a drink while he was waiting. So he's sitting at this bar, and a Catholic priest came in and sat down beside him. And, of course, he struck up a conversation. "I see, my son, you're in the service." "Yes." "Where are you stationed?" "Oh, we're out at Wendover." "Wendover? What in the world are you doing there?" "Well, we're not sure. It's some top-secret project we're going to be involved in." "Aha, yeah. Okay." So he went on home, and he had a telegram waiting for him. When he got back to the base, he was met by the so-called Catholic priest, who was in a business suit, was part of FBI security. We never knew who it was, and maybe it was nobody. Maybe it was just a story that was circulated to catch our attention, which it certainly did, because we realized that they meant business. You didn't know who you were talking to when you left that base.
Was it hard for you to keep that secret? Were there times you were tempted?
Oh, heavens, yes. But fortunately, I somehow or other kept it.
Perhaps you're imagining yourself in those shoes. Would you have been able to keep that secret? Come August 6th, 1945, it would be a secret no longer. We're going to hear how Norris Jernigan experienced that historic moment. We'll revisit what President Harry Truman told the nation in the aftermath, and more perspective from Norris after his recent return to Wendover Field in Utah. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.